Exodus, the plagues as a whole. The 14th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on September 11, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 12, The Plagues as a Whole, accompanies this talk.
This week, as I told you last week, I'd like to talk about the plagues in Exodus as a whole. So we've talked about the first 9 plagues in Exodus that God inflicted on the people of Egypt. There is 10th, but that's special. That's the Passover, and we'll talk about that over the next couple weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. So I wanted to stop at this point and just talk about the plagues as a whole, make some comments, and then I'm going to open up for questions and comments afterwards and be happy to interact with you on those. The question that I want to talk about is why these plagues, of all the things that God could have inflicted upon the Egyptians, why these plagues and why plagues at all? Both questions, I think, need to be asked. God could have acted differently. These plagues were not the only option that God had. He could have acted differently. He could have just come in and killed all the Egyptians and the Israelites could have just walked away. God's capable of doing that, but that's not what he did. He could have appeared in all of his glory like he does on Mount Sinai when we get there and just made an announcement, let my people go, something extremely dramatic like that and forceful. But he didn't. He chose to use plagues, and he chose to use 10 plagues, not one, but a whole bunch of them. But those plagues could have been different evils that he inflicted on Egypt. And I came up with a list just like that of 4 of them. Why not the bubonic plague? That works well. A tsunami, that could have been a good one. An earthquake, fire, all of those could have served his purposes had he chosen to use them, but he didn't. He used blood, frogs, gnats, flies, etc. So why these particular plagues? Now it's possible we just can't answer the question. It's possible that why God did that is too deeply buried in his purposes and not accessible to us. But I think it's worth asking the question and see if we can come to any conclusions with respect to this. I don't know the answer. I'm not really prepared to say that I know the answer. But I'm going to take the first plague, that is turning the Nile to blood, because that's the one that's most talked about by commentators, and I'm going to give 4 different proposals as to why God used that particular plague. And I think from that we can extrapolate generally how people would try to answer the question with respect to the other plagues as well. And then after each one, I'm going to give my critique and then the way that I am thinking about this, at least at this point in time. So, to the question, why blood? Why did God begin the series of plagues turning the Nile into blood? The most commonly given answer, the one that is in most of the commentaries, is that the plagues targeted the gods of the Egyptian pantheon of gods. And in its starkest form, what is argued is that God targeted each plague towards one or more of the gods of the pantheon. So in the span of 10 plagues, he is defeating 10 or more of the Egyptian gods by the plague. The first plague, for instance, with the blood, the Egyptian god Khnum, who was the guardian of the Nile, was shown to be defeated. And the god Hapi, I don't know how to pronounce these words, I'm just guessing. Hapi was the spirit of the Nile. So these 2 gods were both defeated in the first plague. In the second plague, Hekt is the goddess of birth, but is the symbol of Hekt was a frog. And so in the second plague, God defeated Hekt. The third plague, in that plague, it's the gnats, but Moses, I think it's Moses, hit the dust. And so the dust is associated with the gnats. And therefore, what's argued is that Geb, who is the god of the earth, was defeated in that third plague when the gnats were produced. Then there are not good options for 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th plagues, at least that I ran into. There are some that are speculated, but the connections aren't very strong, in my opinion. The 9th plague, where their darkness came over Egypt, that was a plague in which Yahweh defeated Amun-Re, who was the sun god, the most important god of the Egyptian pantheon. It is argued then from this perspective that we just don't know enough about the Egyptian pantheon to be able to designate what the other plagues attacked, but presumably those two were attacking at least one of the Egyptian gods. Okay. My critique is, I think this is possible. It is possible that all of these plagues were hand-picked to attack one or more of the Egyptian gods of the pantheon. There is an interesting statement, an important statement for this perspective in Exodus 12:12, where it says, we haven't got to this yet, but we will get to this next week. It says, "For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord." So that verse is pointed to indicate that the plagues were used to target the pantheon of the Egyptians, judgments against those gods. I'm not sure that it would be possible to associate each of these plagues with one of the gods of the pantheon. They have one. They've got a proposal for plague 3 where we have the gnats, but is there a god of the gnats? They say it's a god of the earth, but is there a god of the gnats? Is there a god of the flies? There's a lord of the flies, but is there a god of the flies? I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but I don't know. And some of the connections that they make are, it seems to me, a little bit tenuous. So I'm dubious that there is a clear association between each of the plagues and one or more of the gods of the Egyptian pantheon. More seriously, however, I am concerned that this is kind of off target. That is to say, that from the account in Exodus, I think it is quite clear that the target that God is going after is not the Egyptian pantheon, but it's Pharaoh himself. That these plagues, however they do it, they are targeting Pharaoh himself. This is a quote from Hofmeyer that I found helpful, and he's making this point, that the plagues are directed towards Pharaoh, not really specifically towards the gods of the pantheon. He says, "The texts reviewed here, spanning from the Middle through New Kingdoms, illustrate that the king was closely associated with the sun, moon, the inundation, and the fertility of the land. Furthermore, the connection between Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt is firmly established. What the plagues of the Exodus show is the inability of the obstinate king to maintain ma'at." Ma'at is the Egyptian word for order. "Rather, it is Yahweh and his agents, Moses and Aaron, who overcome in the cosmic struggle, demonstrating who really controls the forces of nature." In other words, in Egyptian culture, the pharaoh is really the kingpin in this whole process of keeping order in Egyptian society. That the gods are out there, absolutely they're out there, and they all have their powers and they're doing their thing. But it is Pharaoh who is the mediator on behalf of the Egyptian people to that pantheon, to those gods, getting their cooperation and their efforts in bringing about order and holding back the forces of chaos. And from their perspective, chaos is most threatening when it touches on human beings' most important needs, food and shelter and clothing, etc. And those are the things that are under attack in the plagues. So it seems to me that the plagues are really directed towards showing Pharaoh's inability to maintain order. Pharaoh was believed to be a god, sometimes referred to as the son of God, but in Egypt in particular, he seemed to have had God status even while he was alive. And the plagues are showing that he can't do what he claims that he can do. Now, I'm going to make a little digression here. It's not an unplanned digression because it's in my outline, but a little digression. I have been struck in looking at the passages that I've looked at in the Old Testament, how little interest the Bible pays in the forces of evil, that is, Satan, for instance. I think that the Bible teaches that Satan exists. He is a real thing. And I think that it teaches he is a person. But it is interesting to me how little time is devoted to talking about Satan and what he's up to and why he's up to it. I would say the same thing is true of the demons. I assume that they exist. It seems to me that the Bible presents them as being real things. But similarly, there's very little in the Bible talking about how to deal with demons. That when evil is identified, it is primarily a human phenomenon that's designated. And I think it's interesting here that it is a human thing that's being pointed out here. That is to say, it is Pharaoh and all that he stands for. And I would say that includes the whole Egyptian worldview and religious system is under attack here by the plagues. So my critique of that first proposal that the plagues can be accounted for as attacks on the gods of the pantheon of Egypt is that I do think that there is a condemnation of the gods of Egypt. That's part of what's going on in the plague narrative. But I don't think that that's the best way of thinking about the plagues that God sent. Okay, the second proposal. Of this proposal, I saw much mention, but I couldn't find a good, clear presentation of this view. That is to say, I saw mention of this in commentaries, but they are saying this is not the case, and so they are not actually presenting this view. But the perspective is that the blood of the Nile is foreshadowing Jesus coming and sacrificing his life. And this is the best reconstruction that I can offer. And this is mainly based on one website that I found where he doesn't really present a view. He just shows associations. But apparently what he's arguing is that God was signaling that rebellion against God or sin can only be dealt with by the shedding of blood. So blood is important and is the only way that sin can be dealt with. And that corresponds with Jesus' death on the cross. As supporting evidence for this, he points out that a little bit later in the Exodus passage, we have the Passover lamb and the Passover lamb's blood being used to put on the doorposts to steer away the angel of death, and that suggests a substitutionary death for the people of Israel. So it's argued that the account as a whole in Exodus is pointing to Jesus' death on the cross. And as one more piece of evidence that's thrown in, it is pointed out that Jesus in his, I think it says his first miracle is turning water to wine, which is blood-like, and is pointing to the same set of symbols. I would like to see this perspective actually spelled out in detail before critiquing it, but I'll critique it anyway. It doesn't seem to me that it makes sense to claim that the first argue foreshadows the death of Christ. However, the way I think about it, there could be an association here that is important and significant, but there are a lot more steps to it. That is to say, the way I understand the Old Testament, part of what is happening is the development of a whole bunch of symbols, vocabulary, practices that are all helpful in understanding the story of mankind and what God is doing with mankind more generally. So symbols that are put in place that later on are used to good effect because they have significance, they have things attached to them already. So it is, in my mind, it's a lot like teaching a child mathematics and you use manipulatives. And the manipulatives allow the child to visualize a process, and having visualized that process, they can kind of abstract out of that, oh, that's what addition is. Oh, that's what subtraction is. Oh, that's what multiplication is, etc. And it seems to me that a similar kind of process is happening in the Old Testament, that there are many things that are put in place by God that take on significance and meaning that allow people to look at that and say, oh, that's salvation, for instance, or that's guilt, that's etc. And It seems highly likely to me that this plague, where the Nile is turned to blood, is contributing to a set of connotations that comes with the word blood that can be used later on in the Bible. I think that's very, very possible, but foreshadowing, I think, is reaching too far. A third proposal for why the Nile was turned to blood is that it was a condemnation of Egyptian society. Now, I found this one it was a rabbi giving a presentation on this section of Exodus, and I found it interesting because it was quite different. What he argues is that the Nile was Egypt's life. Everything that Egypt had could be attributed to the Nile. Their food, their transportation, everything, one way or another, was tied back to the Nile. And so it was the heart of their life, and it was the heart of their economy. It was also, according to the narrative in Exodus, it was also the means by which the Israelite babies were killed. Pharaoh told the Egyptians to take any baby Hebrews that were born, throw them into the Nile so that they would be killed. And it was a discreet kind of killing. And all of the Egyptians were involved in this. So, as he sees it then, all of Egyptian society, in particular its economic system, economic machinery, and its people, were complicit in the killing of these babies. And that the Israelites, God recognized that the Israelites needed more than just freedom. They needed psychological healing in order to be freed, truly freed, from their slavery in Egypt. So what God did by turning the Nile into blood was to condemn the entire Egyptian way of life, the whole system of oppression. And by so doing, this would bring healing, psychological healing to the Israelites. Okay, my critique. If I were to play this little presentation to you, I think many of you would be struck by the vocabulary that was used to describe this. It seems to me that it's an understanding of this section in Genesis that is highly influenced by Marxism. And I don't mean by saying that, I don't mean to condemn it by association. Marx said some things that are very true, I think, but it just struck me that it was so Marxist in flavor. And it seems to me that there was eisegesis going on, reading into the text rather than explaining the text. There was a bit of that going on. I don't think that the plague narrative is intended to be primarily a socioeconomic critique of Egypt. It seems to me that would be out of place. We haven't been set up for that kind of critique. However, his observation that the babies were thrown into the Nile and the Nile is the thing that turns red, could there be a connection between those two? And I don't know that there is, but it does not seem to me that that is outside of the realm of possibility. It is interesting to me that Pharaoh decided to have those babies killed in such a sanitized way, in a way that was not necessarily gruesome and off-putting, not horribly off-putting for the Egyptians who are asked to be engaged in this activity. So it's a very sanitized way of killing the Hebrew babies. And it does not seem to me that it's impossible that God turned the Nile to blood and as a way of indicating the guilt that actually is associated, and not just with that, but with their oppression of the Hebrews in general. And as I said earlier, I am struck by the fact that the attack in Egypt and Exodus in general is leveled against Pharaoh and as a human institution rather than against spiritual powers. And it could be that it's a broader attack on the society of Egypt. So I don't buy this proposal, but I think that there's the possibility that something has been observed there that's worthy of note. The fourth proposal, the plague as a grand combat. I will need to explain this a bit. There is in the ancient world this myth that's common both in Ugarit, in Egypt, in all of the cultures of the ancient Near East. This common story type, that is a myth in which There is this battle between the gods. There's a battle between good gods and bad gods. And in this battle, the good gods win out, and the bad gods are defeated and done away with. And this is described in very militaristic terms. And in looking at Exodus, there are a number of things that I have observed in this particular section on the plagues that seem to me the vocabulary is drawn from combat. And so that is striking to me. I read one article in particular that I found interesting. I quote from it later. It's by Scott B., and I don't know how to pronounce his last name. I'll pronounce it Nogle. And he points out in this article that throughout this plague narrative, the plagues are interacting with Egyptian culture, that there are various things in Egyptian culture that are being tapped into, and Egyptian culture is being challenged as a whole by challenging all of its parts. He points out many things, but they're just picked out a couple. One is, he argues that when Moses says, I'm not a speaker, I can't talk, he points out that, and many of these things that he observes were drawn from a book that was written, it would have been about 20 years ago now, on Egyptian magic. And it was the first time that someone had pulled together all of the information that we know about Egyptian magic and made it into a coherent whole. And one of the things that this book says about the magicians in Egypt is that they were known as being very eloquent. They were great speakers. And that it was by their speech then, many times, that they were able to perform these acts of magic. So when Moses said he's not a great speaker, what he's saying is, I can't compete. I can't compete with the forces that I will be going against. That is, I can't compete with the magicians of the household of Pharaoh. Another thing he points out is that the three signs that were given to Moses that he's supposed to take back and perform before his people, if you recall, one is the staff that turns into a serpent. The second is the hand that turns, becomes leprous, and then it becomes clean. Then the third one is pouring water out on the ground, and it turns to blood. And he points out that there is a word in Egyptian that means that's a water pourer. And a water pourer is a funerary priest. That is, they poured water on corpses as a part of the commemorating the death of someone. And then he argues that then this becomes symbolic of the water being poured on Egypt itself and declaring the death of Egypt. Then he talks about the first plague in particular, and he thinks that it too is an attack on Egyptian religious culture as a whole. The Egyptian word, Deshur, I don't know how it's pronounced, but D-S with a diacritical mark on it that I couldn't reproduce, R, that can mean either red or blood. That same word can mean either red or blood. But it is synonymous in Egyptian culture, is synonymous with evil. It connotes evil. Furthermore, the same word has strong associations with a certain kind of fish that swims in the Nile, which is a red fish. And so it's associated with this fish, and it's also associated with death. So he sees great significance in what it says in Exodus 7:21 when it says, all the fish in the Nile died. So it turns red and the fish died, is tapping into this whole complex of meanings that are all associated together in Egypt. Quoting from his article, he says, a close look at the account recording Moses before the magicians and the song at the Reed Sea, we'll get to that in a couple weeks, confirms the remark by Currid that the Exodus account is remarkably brimming with elements of Egyptian religious and cultural background. Only an author who is well-versed in Egyptian tradition could have composed such a poignant piece. In addition, these same texts portray the Pharaoh and his magicians as subjected opponents, that is, opponents who have been brought to their knees to be subject to Yahweh, and in a subtle and ironic reversal of roles as unwilling execration victims. The latter is accompanied by a polemical casting of the demise of the Egyptians in the form of a victory song utilizing imagery from Egyptian execration practices. Some of this is referring to stuff that we haven't got to in Exodus yet, but what he's arguing is there are a whole bunch of things that the author of Exodus is drawing upon and suggesting that all these acts are speaking symbolically to Egypt and Egyptian culture, Egyptian worldview, and attacking it and declaring Yahweh's victory over it. This perspective is the closest to capturing, I think, what was intended. The Bible, I think, basically accepts that myth. There is the good God who fights against the powers of chaos and evil and is victorious over them. And it uses that imagery a number of times in the Old Testament. But the Bible identifies that God who keeps chaos at bay as not the God of Egypt, not the God of Ugarit. It's none of those gods, but it is Yahweh himself. But it uses this mythological picture for its own purposes. And in general, it seems to me that the Bible is using and building on the cultural vocabulary both of this mythology and of the other surrounding religions to make the point that it makes. So my attempt at kind of summarizing what I think is happening in Exodus and including what's happening in the plague narrative is that God is saying, I can accept that you as Egyptians are constantly threatened by chaos and evil, and that only mighty spiritual power can keep you safe. I, Yahweh, am the one and only mighty spiritual power to which nothing else can compare. And the greatest form of chaos that you face is moral chaos, and I, through my people Israel, will make known how I have conquered chaos, and in particular, spiritual chaos. That's what I think Exodus is doing, and that's where I think Exodus is going. I'm going to make another digression. This one was not planned, but I think it's been very interesting for me. There were a number of books that were written in the 90s and early 2000s by Egyptologists, and their goal was to take what has been learned about Egyptian culture in the times of the Middle and New Kingdom in Egypt and compare those with the biblical record, because what they're convinced of, these that I'm reading, and I'll give you names in just a minute, what they're convinced of is that if you look at the material in the Bible fairly and you look at it closely, you will see that it has all of the earmarks of a work that was written during the Middle or New Kingdom period in Egypt. Now, that's significant because in biblical scholarship, for a number of years, a number of decades would probably be better, it has been argued that the books of the Pentateuch, that is the first five books of the Old Testament, weren't written until about 800 BC or sometime in that, 800, 700 BC. And that has long been argued, and there are still people who would adhere to that position. But these Egyptologists are saying, if you really look at the text, there's no way that that could be the case, because there are too many indications in the text that it was written in, at the latest, New Kingdom Egypt times. So these authors, and it's Hoffmeyer, can't remember his first name, Kenneth Kitchen, and John Currid are the three authors that have done the most work in this field. But then there are others, associates of theirs, who have done some work as well. So they're going through and pointing out how many, for instance, how many loan words from Egypt there are in the Exodus account. And there are a lot of them. How many practices that are described in Exodus that were the practices in Egypt and were not the practices in other parts of the ancient Near East. One example is in describing the temple and the cloth that's to cover the temple. It's put together from strips of cloth. And the width of those strips is the width that you expected to find in Egypt. That's the way they made big pieces of cloth, with pieces, strips that were that width. Anyway, there are all kinds of things like that that they talk about that are very interesting. But as you go through, there are a couple things that become interesting to me. Not their project, I think, is a good project to do, but I was convinced already that Exodus was not written in the 800s BC. So that particular project is not all that interesting to me, but it is interesting to me to see how much of Egyptian culture has had an impact on the writing of Exodus. And there are a couple of things that strike me about that I find significant. One is, it had escaped my notice until I was reading these. The Israelites coming out of Egypt are culturally Egyptians. For the most part, they are Egyptians. They look at the world through Egyptian eyes. A lot of them didn't really want to go. And once they get into the wilderness, they really want to go back. So they're really looking at the world through Egyptian eyes. And part of what's happening in Exodus and part of what God is trying to accomplish is to de-Egyptianize his people. We can talk about that. That'll be a big thing to talk about later on when we talk about the law. The other thing is, I think in the past I had underestimated the extent to which Exodus is a polemic against the Egyptian worldview, specifically. That Pharaoh and everything he stood for is what's being challenged here and taken to task. And the way I'm looking at it now, it really needs to be read through those eyes. I wish we knew more about ancient Egypt. I was just commenting to my wife, it is striking to me that a lot of the finds that they're working on occurred about 100 years ago. That's when they found some of the tombs and were able to take some of the writings out and started deciphering them. But it's interesting to me that although it's been about 100 years since most of the material was found, there are other things being found, but a whole bunch of it was found 100 years ago. But it wasn't until 20 years ago that someone sat down and wrote about magic in Egypt. That those things are just now being brought together by scholars and put into a coherent form. So it takes a long time for scholars to process this sort of thing and be in a position to be able to give us the kind of picture of Egypt that allows us to make sense of many of the symbols and stuff that are being used, I think, in Exodus. Okay, what do the plagues contribute to the story, the narrative of Exodus? It is clear from the account that one of the things that God, the main thing probably that God is achieving with the plagues is that he wants to make known who he is to Pharaoh, to the Egyptians, and to the people of Israel. The organization of the plagues we talked about before, there are three sets of three plagues. The first, and in each set, it follows the same pattern. The first one in the set of plagues, there's this formal warning that is given. Before the second plague, there's this abbreviated warning that is given. And before the third one, there is no warning. So you have big warning, little warning, no warning. Then it's repeated, big warning, little warning, no warning. And then that's repeated a third time. So it's interesting that what happens is pressure is brought to bear on the people of Israel over the course of the first three plagues that increases. And then it's like we have a reset. And then we start over in that same process, and it builds again a second time and then a third time. What do the plagues tell us about the character of Yahweh? Well, one of the striking things is that he's not quick to destroy his enemies. He gives a lot of warning, and that's a lot of plagues. He gives them 10 plagues. He is very patient. He takes his time, gives people the opportunity to assess and to reevaluate. But he's powerful. In fact, he is incomparably powerful. There is nothing that compares to the power of God. At that time, they thought that gods had their geographical area in which they were particularly strong. But in the Exodus narrative, we see God, Yahweh, who is not an Egyptian god, able to operate and operate effectively in Egypt. So he transcends those kinds of geographical borders. And he goes out of his way to spare his own people. He makes a distinction that the judgments come on the Egyptians, but the judgments don't come on his people. The plagues is condemnation of Pharaoh, and I've talked about this some already. Pharaoh is seen to be the most powerful man in the world at this time, and yet God reduces him to complete impotence. And all of Egyptian society perpetuated this perspective, though, that Pharaoh was the strongest man in the world, and that Pharaoh and his magicians, that they were able to bring prosperity and security to Egypt and should be looked to do so. But the plagues point out that that's all a vicious lie. That's all not true. And that the Israelites are called to believe that that is a vicious lie and that the Pharaoh's power is just a superficial reality. And that is a very important theme, I think, going through here, not just here, but that's elsewhere in the Bible as well, that as we look at the world around us, we are inclined to see it in a certain way. And what we are inclined to do is to see superficial things as being the profound truth and fully explanatory. And I was thinking of an analogy of that phenomenon, and the one that came to mind is chemistry. If I look at this podium, it looks to me like this is a solid object. Things can't pass through this because it's solid. And if I look at things that way, then I was trying to think, what would be the most powerful thing? And I came up with a hammer would be the most powerful thing. It can strike a blow. I mean, we might be able to come up with another thing. But seeing the world from that perspective, a hammer or something like that is going to be, that's what's powerful. But you've probably all had chemistry. You've all learned that there is a deeper reality here. And that is, this is not solid in a sense. In fact, it's mostly space. We've got atoms that are all held by various forces in their positions. And this thing that looks so solid to me is made up of these little atoms separated by a lot of space, such that you take a really tiny particle and it goes right through. And if you think about it from that perspective, then there is a greater force. There's an atomic bomb built from that understanding of the world, which is stronger than most hammers. There's a sense in which I think this is analogous, that we are to understand that reality is different from what it looks like it is. There is a deeper reality that's more profound. It is more explanatory. And if we understand that deeper reality, then we understand how God fits into it and the importance of that. And that, I think, is part of what's being done here, is Pharaoh, the strongest man in the world, is shown to be impotent from a deeper understanding of reality. The plagues are also preparation for the Exodus itself, for the Israelites, encouragement to them. Their perspective is they're looking at all this. Many of them are not certain that God can get them out of Egypt. And yet these plagues are a demonstration of God's power and ability to do what he said that he will do. Many of them don't really want to go, and this is encouragement for them to go. In fact, it puts them in a place where they have to go. Secondly, it's preparation for the Exodus insofar as it predisposes the Egyptians to help the Israelites go. God tells the Israelites to ask the Egyptians for gold and silver, and the Egyptians give it to them willingly. Well, God prepared that, and I think the plagues are part of that preparation. It also turns out to be preparation for the conquest after they leave Egypt. They go through the wilderness, and then they eventually are going to go into the promised land. And word of what God had done here in the plagues and in the Exodus makes its way to Canaan and paves the way for the conquest. And lastly, the plagues are a key moment in human history and salvific history, and we'll talk about that more later. Broader significance of the plagues. The plagues in Exodus seem to have some relationship to the plagues in the Apocalypse, that is, in the book of Revelation. I have listed here, and these are commonly pointed out, some similarities between the plagues in Exodus and the plagues that occur in Revelation. Water is turned to blood. There's mention of that on three different occasions. Hail mixed with lightning that we see in one of the plagues in Exodus appears also in Revelation. We have locusts as one of the plagues in Revelation, as we have in Exodus. Darkness, and that's referred to a couple of times in Revelation, and that is one of the plagues that occurs in Egypt. There are other possible similarities. Frogs, there is reference to frogs in Revelation, and as you know, that was one of the plagues in Egypt. Boils also. And we also have death at the hands of a destroying angel in Revelation, just as we did in Exodus. So there are a number of similarities between the plagues that occur in Exodus and the plagues that are described in Revelation. Now, it is not a clear and obvious connection that's being made. It is not the case that for every plague that's described in Exodus, we have one in Revelation. And there are many more in Revelation than we see described in the book of Exodus. Furthermore, they're in a different order. So we're not seeing a real obvious correlation that's being made between the two books. But I think that God is making some kind of association between the plagues of Exodus and the plagues in Revelation. And I think here we do have some foreshadowing, that the plagues in Egypt were a foreshadowing of the plagues that occur at the end of history. In both instances, they show God's power. In both instances, they are demonstration of the impotence of man's substitutes for God. In both instances, they are gradual. And in both instances, God protects his people from the brunt of his judgment. So it seems to me that what we have in Exodus, in the plagues, is a small-scale picture of the much bigger and more severe plagues that will happen at the end of time, at the end of history. And that is a foreshadowing that God intended. And the judgment that he brings on Pharaoh is a foreshadowing of the judgment that God will bring on the world as a whole. Okay, that's what I was going to talk about. I'll open up for any questions and comments and go from there.
This last summer, we heard a pastor talk about seven churches of Revelation. And one of his points that he was making was that, and he only got to cover the first three or four churches, not all seven of them, but I got his book, and so I'm kind of interested in what did the rest of the way. But the imagery and the information that he was telling the seven churches, we're trying to scrounge around and trying to figure out exactly what that means from today, looking back. But he was saying, at least in part, that the people that were reading John's work at that particular time understood exactly what he was saying, or understood certainly much more clearly than what we're trying to scramble to try to figure out. And he used artwork that was happening, historical facts that was happening within that church at the time, and also coins that were being used and symbols that were on those coins and symbols that were in the artwork. And a lot of it, when you look at it, it was almost, you could see the relationship between what John was saying and what was happening throughout their society. So his point was that they understood a lot more than what, they didn't have to scramble to understand what John was saying like we're trying to do. And the same thing I was just wondering, regards to these plagues. You're scrambling to try to figure out just exactly what God was doing, but I was wondering if it was much more clear to the Egyptians at that particular time. So I don't know if you want to comment on that, but you understand what I'm
absolutely
saying?
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. And that's the
I understand that's kind of where you're, what today was all about, but was it more clear to the Egyptians? Because a lot of times in the Bible, thinking, if I heard stuff like that back then, would I be able to figure out what God was trying to do, or mm-hmm. Would it have been much more clear what was happening?
Mm-hmm. That's the place that I have come to as I've been looking at this more and seeing how much Egyptian influence there was, that is, how much Egyptian vocabulary, and use that in cultural, actual vocabulary, all that sort of thing, how much of that has been drawn upon in order to write Exodus. That has surprised me. It's much more than I thought before. So I think that Exodus is to a large extent a polemic against the Egyptian worldview using the vocabulary of Egyptians. And that's important because it does communicate to the Egyptians, but it also communicates to the Israelites who have been so heavily Egyptianized. And that over time, a lot of that has been lost on us. And we're fortunate that some of that is being recovered now. And that provides a great tool to make sense of this. Just the three signs were given to Moses. Why those signs? Of all of the things, with the same question I'm asking with respect to the plagues. But I suspect that each one of those spoke symbolically into the Egyptian worldview and was an attack on the Egyptian worldview.
Could you revisit the teaching part about red blood and the water pourer quickly?
Yeah. The article that I got this from, the references is on the outline, so you can go look it up. You can find it on the internet. But what he says is that the Egyptian word for blood is also the Egyptian word for red. So it's the same word, has those two different meanings. And what he's arguing is that word is also associated, is kind of a play on words, with the word for a red fish that lives in the Nile, which is associated with the notion of death. So he's arguing that all four of those concepts are interwoven. Red, blood, which have a connotation of evil, this particular kind of fish, and death, that those are all connected. And so he's arguing that by changing the Nile to blood has the connotation of all of those things, evil, death coming on Egypt. And then the water pourer, he says, the word for a funerary priest, a priest who officiates at a funeral, is water pourer. And part of the ritual is apparently pouring water on the corpse. So what he's suggesting is when Moses was told to pour water on the ground, it would turn to blood is one of the signs, that in so doing, he was performing the service of a funerary priest on the land of Egypt. That's the sense in which it was an attack on Egyptian culture and worldview.
So they would refer to the red, and the red was everywhere. There's red all over his clothes. Right? But it would make the words apparently made the same sound. It was the same, actually the same word.
For red and for blood, it's the same word.
So is it possible they didn't have a word for blood? They just said red?
They used that word, yeah. Right. That word has both meanings. So if they're going to talk about blood, they would use that word. But in Exodus, it's written in Hebrew. That doesn't use an Egyptian loan word. It uses the Hebrew word for blood. It doesn't use the Hebrew word for red.
David, the clarity of your presentation of the reason why God used the plagues, you kind of discharged them as you went along, but I think you concluded with something like just a generalization of discharging the Egyptians' worldview at the time. Of the four you presented, starting with discounting the pantheistic ways, I like that the best. That was a good start for my understanding of what's being introduced. Do you have a choice of those four? Can I use choice five, all of the above? So my question, and then a comment will follow, do you have a choice of which one that you presented today is your choice now?
Four reasons why the plagues occurred, plagues in general, not talking about the four different proposals for why the first plague was blood, turning the Nile to blood.
Yes.
Well, it is primarily for God to display his character. That's the main, who he is, manifest himself both to his people and to Egypt. But in so doing, he is taking on Egyptian culture and Egyptian worldview as a whole, and arguing that that is bankrupt, it is dead, it only brings death, and what will be developed later is Yahweh is the way to life.
So I can conclude that your generalization answer is that the Egyptian worldview is bad, and I'm going to introduce a new one. And I'd like to now make a comment, and I bet you'll recall the author Thomas Cahill. And he wrote a series of maybe five books. A third one was How the Irish Saved Christianity. But the first one, and it's something, I don't know the title, something like The Jews Introduced a God. And the theme was, beginning with time, that the introduction of all these pantheistic gods reveled for a while, but that was just a circular way of life. And he, God, introduced the Jews and created the opportunity of confidence in just one God. I think that theme fits your presentation today. Mm-hmm. And if you're interested in using Thomas Cahill's information, I don't think that's too old. Is it applicable to your presentation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. I just want to clarify, an attacking Egyptian culture and the Egyptian worldview, his argument, the argument that's made in Exodus, I think, is being made specifically towards Egypt, but it has broader application. That is, the same critique could be leveled towards any world culture's worldview. That is, they're all bankrupt, and that God is the only, Yahweh is the only source for true security and prosperity. None of those others will ultimately suffice.
I think that really falls into place to what I've tried to introduce as a question or a comment, and I think Thomas Cahill was doing a similar thing. Your clarity today was extremely good.
Thanks. Any others? Okay, thanks.